important strategy is once you are diagnosed with the infection is what needs to happen after that. And with the cases of low risk and high risk, two principles in females. One, low risk viruses tend to only produce the wart or the abnormal pap smear. High risk viruses don't actually cause your skin to grow a wart or the outer area or the vaginal mucosa or the cervix, but they get incorporated up into the cells of that tissue and can cause precancerous changes that, if left untreated, can progress to cancerous changes. 7 out of 10 women will completely clear their virus, whether it is a low risk or a high risk type of virus. Seems in the general population about 7 out of 10 of us can just clear that virus. The other 3 out of 10 seem to have that virus persist in their system long periods of time, years and years. That doesn't mean that in the people who don't clear their virus, they're going to go on to a cancer, but in fact, they may still over years crop up with abnormal pap smears, something like that. It's typical if you're going to clear the virus that you would clear it in about 2 to 5 years, so that if you've tested positive for the actual virus, and this means getting an actual viral test, not just say a biopsy that said maybe you have the virus, or not just a pap smear that says maybe you have the virus. So if you get a positive test for the virus, it's probably not worth even checking to see if you've cleared for that time frame, 2 to 5 years. I usually even say 5 because the tests are relatively expensive and it's not that likely to clear the virus after 2 years. If you have had a surgery for treatment of precancerous changes, it's a little bit more likely that you're going to clear your virus. If you've had medical treatment, there's a medicine that women are often given to clear actual warts called imiquimod, and it's actually not one of these acids. It doesn't freeze or burn the warts, but it actually enhances your own immune system's ability to fight off the warts. And because of that, it's more likely to enhance clearing of the wart. And yes, these viruses can be transmitted skin-to-skin surface, but they do live in what we call epithelial layers, so the surface layers, a cervix, a vagina, the urethral area, the rectal area, the vulvar area. And as far as we know, they would, as a virus, they would have a very fragile life expectancy on any actual surface. Same with, say, herpes virus, something like that. So even if the surface of an object like a toilet seat was in contact with the virus, that virus probably wouldn't survive very long. But for anyone who is worried about toilet transmission of any sexually transmitted infection, we recommend 2 things. One, bleach kills about everything. So dilute spray bottle with bleach, great cleanup for any surface. And secondly, there probably is some truth to that toilet bowl splash could cause some infections, but it's so rare. And in most toilets, that as long as somebody flushed and so forth, that the chance of that is really, really remote. And hopefully that covered all four questions. Yeah,
Thank you. When you say that the person is, that the woman like clears the virus, that means that it's no longer in your system. I mean, it's completely done over. This is not like a virus that lives in the body dormant or whatever.
Well, if you actually clear your virus, no, it's no longer dormant in your system. Now, 3 out of 10 women statistically will still have that virus dormant in their system. And it's not the easiest thing to really get proof positive that there is no longer any virus in any area that could potentially be infected. And as long as you have a dormant case, or as long as a male has a dormant case, it is theoretically still possible for them to pass it along, which is why we have 40 to 60 million Americans in the United States today infected with HPV.
Right. But if he has 15 years of normal pap smears, I mean, the odds on that having continued for 15 years are very, very small, right?
Relatively smaller, yes.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Our guest here this morning on Focus 580, Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist. She's here on the program each month. On a Monday, we talk about women's health. And your questions are welcome. I know she will do her best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
I'd like to say one other thing about HPV that we've talked about recently, that the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the American Cancer Society have been looking very hard at their general recommendations for how often to have pap smears. And at the same time, some of the newer technologies, we've talked about the liquid-based pap smears and these new HPV detection systems, have also at the same time been working to provide better tests. And the FDA has now approved HPV testing for women over the age of 30 as a primary screening mechanism for cancer. And in fact, if you've had a liquid-based pap and a negative HPV and you are at low risk and have had at least three normal pap smears in the time leading up to these two tests being negative, you would potentially be somebody that could safely go to pap smear testing every 2 to 3 years. As you know, we've probably mentioned this before, that women on Medicare have screening pap smears paid for every 2 years. And I think we'll start to see some of the pap smear testing spacing out. Now, patients often confuse the concept of pap smear with the concept of pelvic exam. And even though you may be able to space out those pap smears, the recommendations still are to get regular pelvic exams if you have a uterus and an ovary. Now, if you've already had a hysterectomy for benign disease and you've never had any abnormal paps prior to the time of the hysterectomy, then and you no longer have a uterus, tubes, or ovaries and no gynecologic symptoms, you could space out both your pelvic exams and your pap smears. And some recommendations say that once you've had a hysterectomy for benign disease, you no longer need future pap smears. But many of us physicians feel that that's probably not the wisest management course for most of our patients. You would want to talk to your individual doctor, but at the time of hysterectomy, there still can be a few cells of the cervix, even a microscopic little area left at the upper part of the vagina, and also the vagina itself can undergo some of the same precancerous and cancerous changes as the cervix could. So probably spacing out pap smears post hysterectomy for benign disease is reasonable, but probably not stopping altogether.
Okay. We have another caller here. Some other callers, another cell phone person, so we'll go there first. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello, Dr. Troopin. I have a relatively new phenomenon. I'm in my mid-40s and a new sex partner of the past year. And for the first time in my life, I am experiencing irritation in the urethra after intercourse. I've gone through antibiotics, preventative, and as intervention, only to find there's never been any bacteria at all. I've had been to a urologist, and they have no idea what it is. As I search for it, I can't find other people who are experiencing irritation in the urethra as a result of intercourse. That's the only time it happens. I wonder if you have any thoughts on this, if you've seen it before, any thoughts on prevention?
Once women get in their 40s, actually, your genital complaints after intercourse is extremely common. And you're right to search for infectious causes, because infectious causes, particularly of the urethra, are fairly common. And two groups of organisms that you may not have been tested for are chlamydia. And we always test for gonorrhea at the same time we test for chlamydia, but gonorrhea of the urethra is much less frequent than is chlamydia. And
we did both of those.
Okay. And mycoplasma and ureaplasma, those are also urinary and urethral tract pathogens that aren't as commonly tested for. So probably if you want a thorough investigation for infection, those things can be done. There are some people who do test. We were just talking about HPV. There are some people who do test positive for HPV of the urethra, but whether or not that leads to symptoms is a little bit more controversial. typically, if you assume that you've had all the tests and they're all negative, then most likely the cause is a lower estrogen effect of those tissues, and that for whatever reason it's manifesting itself in your case more in the urethral area than in the introital area, which is the outer opening of the vagina, or the vulvar area. And that is really well treated with local application of estrogen. There are rings, there are creams, there are, you can have gels made. Happen to not do well with the creams, there are tablets that can be used, and actually even oral estrogen can work, as well as can patch estrogen. So there are a lot of different options, and that's probably the most common cause in women your age.
And are you referring to a lack of lubrication as the cause, and that's why you would use the estrogen?
Well, in some women, it may manifest as lack of lubrication. In other women, it can be a atrophy of the lining tissue, so that if you would do, say, a look at, under the microscope at those layers of tissue, there's a basal layer of the upper tissue, and then there are what's called basal cells, intermediate cells, and superficial cells. And in women treated with estrogen, they have a fairly thick superficial cell layer that is a tougher kind of layer. And in women, say, as they get farther into menopause, particularly if they're not using any estrogen, have mostly basal cells. And so the medical term for that is atrophy, and using estrogen just kind of toughens up that area a little bit. It makes it less sensitive.
I see. Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. We have someone here in College Park, Maryland. Line number three. I'm assuming you're listening on the internet. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right.
Thank you again. I have a question that's a little different from the previous callers. I've been diagnosed with PCO, polycystic ovaries, and I have fibroids also. And what I've noticed in the last year or so is that there's been a change in my hair. I've never done any chemical treatments or colors, and it colored my hair. It just seems like my hair is thinning, and I'm really not sure what to do. I'm trying supplements. I've changed my diet. You know, I've even stopped taking birth control pills, and I'm trying to supplement my estrogen through phytoestrogens with soy, and I'm just getting really discouraged. So I wanted to know if there's any products that women can use that will kind of help retain what kind of hair, what hair they have left, and hopefully give it a chance to, you know, come back. I was a little discouraged by some of the topical treatments because I worried that if they got on my pillow and I was sleeping at night, I might start getting like facial hair or something growing. So I don't know if it's the same receptors, you know, in your face as on the top of your head, but if you can give me some suggestions what I can do, because I'm starting to get very concerned about this. Thank you very much, and I'll just hang up and listen on the internet.
Okay, well, thank you for the call. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a terrific question, and one that bothers a lot of women, and hair loss is actually shown to be one of the major psychological stresses. If, in general, you think about teenagers, they have lots of hair, and if you think about women in their, say, 80s and 90s, they tend to have sparse hair, and strictly aging does cause some hair loss. We all get seasonal hair loss, and actually we typically regrow in the winter a little bit and lose more in the spring, summer, just like dogs and whatever cycle their coats. It's important to always have that initial examination to make sure you have no actual scalp disease, and that would be more in the realm of a basic family doctor, and many basic OBGYNs can at least do a basic kind of exam. But there are some scalp conditions, and that's important to make sure. In this case, the caller said she wasn't doing anything much to her hair, but certainly in cases that I see women who do style their hair, color their hair, blow their hair dry, wash their hair frequently, all those things actually do lead to some hair loss that adds up. The topical applications of medicines are very safe and successful and are the most successful things that we have, things like Rogaine that we get over the counter. There are some more intense treatments than that, but they're primarily approved for use in men and really aren't approved for use in females. The fact that she has uterine fibroids, of course, has nothing to do with whether or not she has hair loss. The fact that she has polycystic ovarian condition, she didn't really say, to what degree, but, may or may not be related. There is some evidence that, male hormone abnormalities can lead to, various changes in hair. If the male hormone levels are very, very high, some people have excess hair growth, but not so much on their head, but in other unwanted places. So it may or may not be related, and it may or may not be, in her individual case, worth seeing a physician, getting some hormone tests. But by and large, most of the hair loss we see is either heredity, and it runs on the mom's side. So if your mom's dad was bald, you may be bald too. And women, they get the same male pattern baldness where in the back of their head they get a lot of thinning, and in the temporal region they get a lot of thinning. Stress, and even if for whatever reason you don't think that there's additional stress in your life, stress can cause it. And truthfully, there are very few actual medical conditions, and treatment of hair loss has been actually still fairly frustrating for a lot of women who were used to having really big hair, and they get into particularly their 40s and start to notice what they consider premature hair loss, but it's actually fairly normal. One thing that a physician can do is they can look to see if in the areas where you've lost hair, if you have little bits of growth on the hair follicle, and if you do, then you are still at least cycling and replacing some of the hair that you've lost, and that's a healthy sign.
Okay. Well, again, I hope that helps. We're here on a midpoint. We'll continue to take calls. We have two other people who are here ready to go. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's here once a month, always on a Monday. We talk about women's health. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The next two callers are in Champaign. First, line one. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering if you think that people should, or women should, have a gynecological exam. If you see your doctor annually, should that be sufficient, or do you think a separate gynecological test? I used to when I was younger, but now that I'm a senior, I haven't had, he hasn't said anything, and I haven't had it for a very long time.
Well, yes, I do think dealing with your gynecologic health is important throughout your lifespan. And as I was saying earlier, as we get older, depending on what has gone on in our case, do we have any actual symptoms? Have we had any prior surgery? Have we had any prior abnormalities? Are we having bladder problems, which one-third of our seniors, and actually in some of the newer studies, one-half of the seniors actually have some problems with either fecal or urologic incontinence that can be dealt with on a basic gynecologic exam. And I think that those issues are important to be covered. Many of us are still sexually active as we are seniors, and I think that that is a very important issue to discuss. Of course, cancer screening is important. Cancer screening for cervical cancer, cancer, endometrial cancer, which is lining of the uterus, cancer, and ovarian cancer as well, are the primary areas of gynecologic cancer screening. Whether or not you include the breast there, many gynecologists do, but I was presuming by your call you're pretty strictly talking about a pelvic exam. And based on your own history and risk factors, that pelvic exam may or may not need to be done on a regular basis, meaning every year. And exactly who provides that exam, I don't think that there is any specific guidelines as to who should do that exam. Your healthcare provider could be a midwife, it could be a PA, it could be a nurse practitioner, could be a board-certified obstetrician-gynecologist, could be an internist, it could be a family medicine physician. And I think that it's more what the kind of provider that you've selected and more driven by your healthcare plan, your health, overall health needs. Somebody should be primarily in charge of your medical plan, and meaning not your insurance plan, meaning the plan for your health care, you yourself. And if you have a primary care physician, you should bring up the subject, and that primary care physician should then direct what you need, and whether he or she then performs the exam or refers you for the exam is probably more up to that individual physician.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, in the past, he's never said anything about seeing a gynecologist, so I don't know.
But many family medicine physicians can...
Pardon?
But many primary care physicians do incorporate gynecologic care into their care, mm-hmm. and it isn't necessary to be referred on.
Uh-huh. I see. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Champagne, another caller here, line number two. Hello.
Hi, I just wanted to comment on the lady who called in with the mysterious urethral infection problem. I had the same problem once when I had a new sexual partner, but I also had a new birth control method. I was using a diaphragm, and the diaphragm pinched something in there and caused those symptoms to appear. It mimicked a urethral infection, although it wasn't really. It wasn't really. I had tests done also. But the minute I stopped using the diaphragm, the problem went away.
Well, that is a good point. Some physicians, when they fit the diaphragm, they fit them much tighter. When a diaphragm is properly fit, during intercourse, the back part of the vagina sort of opens and widens, and the diaphragm actually moves backwards a little bit and really shouldn't be sitting directly at the bladder neck, which is the angle between the urethra and the bladder, but should be sitting back a little bit farther than that. But it's not just so much where the diaphragm's sitting or how tightly it's fit into the vagina. We think that there are other issues. Number one, you could be allergic to the spermicide. Number two, you could be allergic to the latex. And number three, there's something physically about using diaphragm, cervical caps, and condoms that actually increase your risk for infections of the urinary tract. And we don't really know why that is, but they have studied one of the bacteria that is most commonly associated with those infections called E. coli. And E. coli attach better and to the surface of the genital tissues, particularly the bladder and the urethra, if somebody uses either a diaphragm, condoms, or a cap. And so that is a good point, but we would think that maybe some of the symptoms are more typically related to whether or not you're getting infections, because bladder infections are so much more common in diaphragm users.
Right. Well, I just wanted to make that comment because that was something that when I changed it, I didn't have the problem anymore. So... Mm. Thank you.
All right.
Excellent.
Well, thank
Thanks.
You again. To another caller here, someone on a cell phone, line three. Hello.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Rupin, if a person believes they have a yeast infection, in other words, if they had it in the past and it suddenly occurs, again, is it possible for a woman who's postmenopausal, who also does not have a hysterectomy, is it possible to still have a yeast infection? And if so, if there's some blood staining, is that, you know, does that occur?
Well,
I guess what I'm saying is if you use Monistat, would that be, or do you need to go to your primary?
Well, in general, yeast infection shouldn't lead to any bleeding of the vaginal wall tissues. It is possible once you're postmenopausal, if you are not using hormone therapy for that process of atrophy that we were talking about relative to other issues, for that to go on. And in the process, if you have a lot of atrophy, that can lead to blood staining, whether or not you have yeast infection, but that's something that would be more appropriate for your physician to diagnose than yourself. The symptoms of atrophy can produce a fairly heavy, fairly whitish, chunky discharge in some women that could be mistaken for yeast. So if you've really not had an infection for a long period of time and it's accompanied by bleeding, that's probably not the ideal infection to treat over the counter. Now, if you can't get right in to see your provider, you know, yeast medication over the counter, it's relatively inexpensive and very safe to use. And, you know, it's not harmful to try, but probably an exam by a healthcare provider is warranted.
Okay. Well, thank you very much and have a happy holiday.
All right. Thanks. Thank you. Well, that maybe that just raises a question about, for women who have had trouble with yeast infection and they know what it is, they recognize the symptoms, there are now over-the-counter medications that are available. You can go down to the drugstore and you can buy the stuff to treat it. And I guess the question is, at what point do you say, well, I know what this is, I'll just go down and take care of it? And at what point do you think, well, maybe it might be a good idea to make an appointment with my doctor and have it checked just to make sure that is what it is, there's nothing more serious going on, and so forth. Just, you know, just to be sure everything's okay.
Well, it is relatively, for a physician like myself, something that was considered a new concept. Actually, we participated, I participated as an investigator in the study that led to the first yeast medication, Monistat, going over the counter. So that was kind of exciting. It was a number of years ago already, and probably most people don't even remember when you needed a prescription for yeast medication. And of course, the package inserts are designed to give you some sort of guidelines about when to see your physician and when not. And since these products have gone over the counter, we've also done some follow-up research studies. And even when, even when people think that they are following the appropriate guidelines and precautions, we still have a fairly high error rate in diagnosis. And actually, one recent study showed that about 40% of people misdiagnose and they really don't have yeast, even though they think they do. So in general, you shouldn't ever treat your very first infection, so that you should see a healthcare provider. If you have what's called there are two new terms that have crept into the gynecologic care of yeast patients, and one is recurrent vulvovaginitis, and the other is chronic vulvovaginitis. And basically, both those terms are fairly similar, and they have some slight differences in their medical definition. But the point is that if you have frequent infections, so three or more a year is called frequent, then you definitely need to get in and have an exam. Also, if the last time you were diagnosed with an infection, you haven't now got the identical symptoms, but the symptoms do seem a little bit different, then it's definitely worth being examined. And if you just have an infection like the caller we were talking to, out of the blue, many years since you've had another infection and the signs and symptoms aren't completely classic, that's a good time to get a doctor's care. And of course, if you're pregnant, we like you to seek a doctor's advice rather than self-treat.
We have about 15 minutes left here with Dr. Troopin. If you have questions, you are certainly welcome to call 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Well, there were a couple of things you said you thought you might like to talk a little bit about. And one of the things on the list was sleep. And me, Mr. Wise Guy, said, well, it's a good thing, right? And you said,
it is
yes,
a good thing.
In fact, it's a good thing. And I think that probably one of the things that we know is that most people don't get enough, and being sleep deprived does have health consequences.
Absolutely. And it can affect your memory. It can affect your mood. And in my field, menopause, it has dramatic effects both ways. Menopause has a dramatic effect on sleep, and sleep can, in fact, have a fairly dramatic effect on hot flashes or vasomotor symptoms. And the recent research that we talked about a few years back even was about estrogen use and sleep. And we found that, yes, in menopause, if you treat your hot flashes or your night sweats or your nighttime awakening with estrogen, your sleep does slightly improve and you get what's called faster sleep onset. So they call that sleep latency, how long it takes you from the time you turn off that light to actually fall asleep. And you get a better sleep profile, so more dreams, the appropriate rapid eye movement kinds of sleep, and more natural sequences that lead to non-dream and dream sleep. And you get more effective hours. A lot of menopausal patients will tell me that it takes a long time to fall asleep, and they get up a couple of times, and sometimes they awake at 3 a.m. and just cannot get back to sleep. And it's a persistent problem, and it's becoming more of a common problem as we take patients off estrogen who've been on estrogen a long time, or caution patients in light of some of the new risks to not consider estrogen use. So we still have this group of patients that may or may not benefit from other kinds of therapy that would improve their sleep. And it's one thing that, not quite yet, but probably later January, early February, we're going to be an investigative site of a new medication that is not estrogen-based that is designed to treat menopausal sleep troubles.
The other thing that you were thinking about talking a little bit about was osteopenia, which is the loss of bone. There's osteoporosis, which is thinning of bone. There's osteopenia, which is loss of bone mass, both of them age-related, and the kinds of things that you see after menopause. And that's one of the reasons that women maybe are replacing hormones or doing other kinds of things that aren't hormone-related because of that.
Well, there's just a tremendous amount of new research in the area of bone health. And of course, our ultimate goal is to prevent people from having fractures. Right. And some of the more sensitive areas of our body are areas of what we call trabecular bone. So the areas of the spine, the wrist, and the hips. And trabecular bone is particularly sensitive to early loss, particularly as our hormones go down. So leading into the time of menopause, in early menopause, post-menopause, and one of the areas that I'm extremely interested in is just after you go off your hormone therapy. Again, here's this whole new area of medicine. We've spent a lot of time getting a lot of patients on hormone therapy, and we still feel that hormone therapy is an important treatment for some women with the early signs and changes of menopause. But now I think we're trying to bring science to the getting the patients off the menopausal therapy. And in fact, when you stop hormone therapy, new studies show that your bone loss is maybe more rapid than it is at any other time of your life. So this has become a fascinating area. We also do have to watch a little bit about our definitions. The term osteopenia and osteoporosis are specific applied definitions to women in the menopause who have certain scores on their bone density that have been designated by the World Health Organization to qualify them for those definitions. I think last radio show I was talking about some of the newer guidelines from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists that even recommend women in the ages of 19 to 39, because we do everything by age groups. This group happens to be a big group, but so between 20 and 40, essentially, it's 19 to 39 is the official grouping. But with those women, women who may be at risk for early bone loss are recommended to have some sort of bone testing. It could be a peripheral test like your heel, your wrist, or your finger, or it could be the more complete test of your lower spine and your hips, unless you're over 300 pounds, you got to do the wrist. The machines aren't set up to accommodate women over 300 pounds for their hip and spine tests. But with these women, even if their scores on these bone tests are low, they aren't formally called osteopenic or osteoporosis, because those terms themselves are designed to predict fracture risk. And even if you have a low bone mass at a young age, say you're 30, 35, 40, and you have a low bone mass, yes, it's worrisome, because you're going to probably run into problems as you age, but your chance of having a fracture at your young age, even given a fairly low bone status, is actually fairly low. And part of that has to do with bone structure. And this is another area of research where we're trying not just to say how thick a bone is, but what else is going on physiologically. How fast is that bone turning over, which you can measure with urinary markers? Is something going on health-wise? What's your blood calcium level? What's your blood vitamin D level? We live in the north, and actually low vitamin D is fairly common, and now being treated more commonly with vitamin D injections rather than just even the supplements if you get too low. And also, there's new research on actually using more sophisticated analysis. The early research did bone biopsies, but trust me, this is not something anybody signs up for very easily. They're very painful. But on biopsy research, we've started to look more specifically at structure. You might think of it as say you have a four-legged stool, and you know how some of the four-legged stools have bars in between the different legs of the stool that are perpendicular. And if you took those bars away, your stool would still be standing, but the overall weight that stool could accommodate would be very, very low, versus if you took one of the big four legs away, that stool wouldn't be standing at all. But actually, overall density wise, it might measure okay. So we're starting to realize that occurs with trabecular bone on a microscopic level. It's not just how much thickness, but still knowing your bone density thickness is extremely important, and important for people who've had irregular periods, important for smokers. There are certain medicines, hypertensive medicines, other medicines, that can lead to seizure medicines that can lead to overall low bone mass. And I think that knowing your T and Z scores, which are the measurements that come off of those bone density tests, is going to be one of those important numbers, just like, you know, what's your cholesterol number? This is going to be one of these very important numbers that we're going to recommend that people know about themselves. Yeah.
Well, obviously here at women, there could be a number of risk factors that a woman would have that would make it more likely she would develop osteoporosis, including these things that you mentioned and simply family history. Are physicians now thinking that at some point there should be all women, no matter what their medical history, should have some kind of screening package done, including bone density scan and maybe some of these other things?
Right. It's moving that way. There are a number of organizations, the National Osteoporosis Foundation, which has an excellent website, American College of Radiologists, American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the World Health Organization, and they all have their own ideas about who needs to be screened when. There's the International Society for Clinical Densitometry. It has a pretty reasonable website also, and they provide certifications for those of us doing bone density testing. And I was just at one of those certification courses, and the intricacies are getting more and more complicated. And the bottom line is that there are many guidelines out there. And unfortunately, like we talk about with mammograms and to some extent pap smears, some of these different organizations have varying ideas. And I think it's still at the point where an individual patient should talk to her individual healthcare provider and come up with a plan certain health plans are now providing funding for bone density screening at earlier and early ages, but some don't. And so the cost of what the screening is going to be may influence. A test of just, say, the wrist could or the heel could be in the range of, you know, $75, $80, something like that, although I know sometimes health fairs provide free testing. But you're right, we're going to move to more and more of those screening panels, and they'll be much more sophisticated, and they will be targeting individuals with risk factors, because we think that at least 50% of all osteoporotic fractures are completely preventable. And, of course, before we get too excited about risk factor testing, which is why I'm always interested in general screening, is that a huge percentage of people who do develop osteoporosis, unfortunately, don't have any of the traditional risk factors.
Hmm. So other than for women, even when they're younger, other than making sure that they get adequate calcium and vitamin D, and in addition, it's good to have some weight-bearing exercise. Is there anything, and you're saying that probably for a variety of reasons you would say don't smoke, that would be a good thing not to do. Is there anything else that women, that, you know, for our daughters, when they are younger, we want them to be doing to try to do whatever we can to build and maintain health, strong, healthy bones?
Well, I think there'll be a lot more investigation of medication, a lot more screening when you're getting treated. For instance, steroids can cause a lot of bone loss, and glucocorticoid steroid administration, particularly to asthmatics in the United States, is responsible for a large percentage of bone abnormalities in men as well as women. And actually, they're now saying that men at the age of 70 should at least be screened for their bone density and younger if they had other risk factors. But I always say I don't follow the male literature very closely. So when people call and ask, that's a point. And then it's important for us to know what's going on with these medicines. Bones to be healthy need to turn over. But the flip side of that is that if they turn over too fast, then too much calcium leaches out of our bone and it is not as strong. And so that's currently the basis of most our medication. Our medication slows down the rate that bone loss does occur and stimulates on the local bone level bones to hang on to their calcium. And exactly how long you stay on these medicines is really important. And for women, and this is the study that we're also going to be starting in probably late January, early February. What medicine is it then most ideal to switch to if, in fact, you have low bone once you are going off your hormone therapy? And trying to understand the biology behind making those decisions is going to be part of the research that I'm participating in.
Okay. Well, I guess we leave it at that for this time around. I want to say thank you very much.
Thank you
for being here. Dr. Suzanne Trupin, she is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has practice here in our area. She also teaches at the U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign once a month. She's on this program, always on a Monday, and we talk about women's health.